steal the Sanchoronium. They gathered their things, lockpicks, bags, gloves, and garbed themselves in black. Before they left, Cochin lifted his seat cushion to reveal a compartment in the bench. From it, he drew two masks. She stared at them. Where Cochin's fox mask smiled emphatically, hers was a fish, comically sad, with a lone tear falling from its bulging eyes. Is this necessary?
Oh, absolutely.
So, you're a fox, and I'm a fish? They're characters from Yaongi's fables, Cochin said. Nika had suspected his mask was a nod to the trickster fox when she'd first met him. With both intrigue and sadness, she wondered why, of all the creatures he could have chosen, Cochin had picked a villain. She remembered the story of the dismal carp, too. Isn't this the fish that cries so much he creates all the rivers on Yarong? Yes, Cochin said, flashing her a grin. He does nothing but complain all the time. Before she could reply, he'd hopped out the door. They left in the evening, setting off across the water. This time, instead of returning to the dockyards, they pulled ashore in the Dragonborough. There, they disembarked on a private beach of gray pebbly sand and dragged their boat toward the shelter of the cliff. Up the cliffside, the spacious gardens and well-lit streets of the Dragonborough welcomed them. Dr. Santo's mansion was atop a hill, not with the acreage of the Kongmi's manor, but with a garden and a sloping driveway all the same. He had an eye for extravagance, finials atop every roof, and limestone walls carved with intricate scenes. The home even had an outdoor water system, with waterfalls trickling through porous rocks and into koi ponds. Nika whistled at the sight of it, as she and Cochin found a place to observe, far from the house and out of lamplight. "Does Dr. Santo have much of a family?" she asked, arms crossed as she watched shadows move inside the house.
"Not anymore," Cochin replied. "His wife left him after the death of their son."
Nika recalled her conversations with Dr. Santo about his son. Layton, was it? Looking back in hindsight, she was surprised it was the truth, rather than another part of his elaborate lies. "The boy with the hole in his heart." Cochin nodded. "You can't help but feel bad for him, can you? Even after everything he's done. I can't even imagine that. Losing someone you love when you feel you could have saved them." Nika made a noise of agreement, but she knew exactly how that felt. The house brightened with lights. The hum of an engine announced Dr. Santo's auto carriage, which pulled down the driveway. She and Cochin ducked into the cover of the alley, watching him until he traveled down the road and turned the corner. Before they entered, they waited for the house to settle, lights flickering back to darkness and quiet befalling the street. Then they meandered toward his home, acting as though they belonged there, their pace casual and inconspicuous. The temperate weather afforded them the leisure of a stroll, and when they slipped into Dr. Santo's garden, Nika cast a glance over her shoulder to ensure that no one had spied them from an open window. The garden offered a rock path that wound up the side of the property, a convenient avenue into the house. The entrance was through a garden portico, the wall lined with shuttered windows that Nika shied from. She walked past Cochin toward the door, leaning close in the dying light. The mask constricted her view, as did the growing darkness, but Nika had prepared for this. She slipped her lockpick set out of her bag and set to work on the lock, going by sound and feel more than anything else. Just like heart-soothing, lockpicking was another skill her grandmother had left her, though sired more by necessity than tradition. And as with heart-soothing, Nika had perfected it during her time on the streets, whenever she needed a warm place to sleep when she was between apartments. Her lockpick ticked against the tumblers, ever light. She tapped them into place, feeling the resistance of the cogwork as she placed tension on the wrench. It turned in full when the last tumbler fell into place, and the lock clicked open.
"You make it look easy," Cochin said as she opened the door into a dark foyer.
"It is," she said,
jerking her head toward the shadowed room. He stepped past her, and she closed the door. They crept forward in the darkness. Nika fought the urge to remove her shoes when they reached the polished hardwood of the tea room, with its low tables and chairs oriented toward the garden. Around the corner, from somewhere farther down the hallway, a light flickered and moved. A gas lamp. Cochin took her arm, ushering her into the cover of the pantry. The whiff of pungent herbs and roots tickled her nose under the mask, a sneeze threatening to let loose. She bit it down. The gas lamp passed. Nika peered out of the pantry in time to see the back of a maid retreating down the hall.
"Going home for the day, let's hope," Cochin said.
"Dr. Santo keeps his secrets close. I can't imagine he keeps staff around after hours."
"I suppose we'll see. Where's his office?"
"Around the corner." Nika let Cochin take the lead as they slunk forward, the hardwood creaking underfoot. This house used more of an open concept than the Kongmi's manor, rooms widening up into one another, walled by paper screen paneling with few hallways in between. Sure enough, the office was down the hall, an inviting room. It was plainer than Nika had expected, but that meant fewer places where the Sankaronium could hide. Careful not to displace anything, she and Cochin set about searching, pulling drawers and examining cabinets. Cochin had said it would be a brown glass bottle, but she found nothing of the sort in his desk or shelves, just bound literary anthologies and medical journals. On the wall, he displayed plaques of his credentials, gleaming gold in the light. Beside them hung framed publications. Dr. Santo had true achievements. But the most prominent paper, that of his groundbreaking transplant, left a bitter taste in her mouth. Cochin hadn't been credited at all.
"Any luck?"
Cochin asked, drawing her attention.
"None.
Me neither."
She could hear the disappointment in his voice, though his mask concealed it.
"Upstairs, then. He has a private study where he may keep research materials."
Private study it was. Clicking off the lights, Nika followed him down the hall, where a cubic stairwell took them to the second floor. She glanced out the window as they passed, watching as a throng of women departed down his driveway.
"We might be alone now," she said, grin spreading.
"Maybe before we go, we should take a quick peek at his pantry."
"What are you in the mood for?"
"I'm sure he has something expensive." Nika thought back to the illicit goods she'd seen at the butcher's row. "Shark fin? Black chicken meat?"
"Shark fin? Black chicken?"
He flashed her a look. "Aren't those aphrodisiacs? Now, why would you want those?" His teasing tone brought heat to her cheeks, and Nika was suddenly thankful for the mask.
"That's not what I meant. Surely a medical professional such as yourself doesn't believe in such properties."
"Maybe I do. I have been in business with the butcher's row."
Nika quieted, measuring his sincerity. He only gave her an impish look, eyes smiling through the mask, and she laughed.
"And you must also believe that eating a blood carver grants you their gifts, don't you?"
"I believe the original myth was having the heart of a blood carver, which I already have."
"His heart or hers?" Nika didn't want to ask. They reached the top of the stairs, and he turned the corner, stopping abruptly before a closed door. He tried the handle. Locked.
"This is promising," he said, deferring to her.
She retrieved her lockpicks again and crouched before the door. This lock came undone with ease, and she swung the door open to reveal a dark study, smelling of ink and paper. No windows here, but she saw the shadowy outline of a desk. Cochin stepped inside and turned on the light.
Holy Mother! It was as though a library had swept through this room by monsoon.
Where his office had been orderly, his private study was a mess of loose papers, opened books, torn pamphlets. Corkboards lined the walls, pinned with an assortment of scraps. The shelves were only half full, the remaining books occupying the floor in varying degrees of abuse. A typewriter sat on a desk in the middle of all the mess, a half-finished document in its platen.
Nika navigated between the papers and books and open inkwells to stand before the typewriter. It seemed to be a write-up of some research paper. She recognized terminology pulled from the literature she'd spent so long studying, something about life-sustaining technology. A quick scan of the surrounding documents showed that they'd been excerpted from past research, torn from journals, scribbled with notes.
"The man is undeniably dedicated," Nika said, the gravel in her voice a symptom of her wariness.
"No," Cochin said, his tone hollow. He'd stopped in front of one of the corkboards.
"He's deranged."
Nika drew closer to him, eyes exploring the corkboard. It took her a moment to comprehend what she saw, but then her lungs stopped working. There was a photograph of a human chest splayed open, skin held back by pins to reveal the thoracic anatomy underneath, membrane encasing the heart and lungs open to the air. A scalpel hovered just in frame, blurred in the photograph. With the cold echo of horror in her own chest, she realized the patient was staring at the camera, still awake, not in surgery, but in vivisection. And he was Yerongi's. Surrounding the photo were anatomical diagrams, meticulous and detailed, of humans sliced open, their craniums drilled, their brains exposed. Headlines and excerpts of articles joined them, written in Dalton. Reincarner ve morts, bloodskulver aus zen vivex. Things she couldn't understand, but recognized as horrific. With a shuddering breath, she stepped backward, feeling pain bloom across her body, as though it were her in those drawings and photographs.
Did he do this?
She asked, voice stricken. Cochin peered closer.
No, these are Dalton photos.
He shared a glance with her, and the room dropped a couple degrees in warmth. She'd heard about the Dalton experiments, the persecution of Hartsus when the island first fell under attack. She just never had an image to put to it.
"Let's find what we need and leave," he said, a hand on her arm to swivel her away.
It was too late. The image was already burned onto her retinas. They moved to the shelves, upending books in search of a drug bottle. What she found instead were Dalton journals, filled with studies on Hartsus, volume after volume, some with detailed images and others with photographs. These were texts that Thumis had decried, not on grounds of immorality, but invalidity. Daltony had sliced through Hartsus with little method nor hypothesis, like children before a new toy. Yet, Dr. Santo had collected them all here in his twisted library, had used them as gospel. In those images, she saw her mother, her father, grandmothers, and great-grandfathers, and a long, broken lineage that had been lost to time. No, not lost. Stamped out. Persecuted.
"Don't look, Nika," Cochin said,
the shake in his voice mirroring the tremble in her breath.
"Let's just focus on the Sancharonium."
She nodded wordlessly, moving to the next shelf. They tore through the study, searching beneath papers and behind columns of stacked books, but to no avail. Dread gripped her fingers as she examined Dr. Santo's desk, as though the drawers would hide more graphic images. When she opened the uppermost drawer of his desk, her eyes caught on the silver frame of a portrait. She winced, fearing something gruesome. But it wasn't any Dalton vivisection. Instead, it was a photo of a younger Dr. Santo with a boy in his lap. Wide eyes and chubby cheeks, looking flushed in tight and formal clothing. Dr. Santo, who'd locked a grip on his shoulder, smiled placidly at the camera. But the boy stuck out a playful tongue at the photographer, his face blurred with mischief.
"They're not here,"
Cochin muttered, appearing at her side. Nika surveyed the Dalton papers strewn across the room one more time. Her eyes ended on the photograph of Dr. Santo's son, so out of place in this room.
"Let's lock this room back up. We weren't meant to see this."
She almost wished she hadn't. Without needing any more prompting, Cochin took her from the room, locking the door behind them. Keeping quiet, they scoured the other rooms that might hold medication, the kitchen, the bedrooms, the basement. Cochin upturned every cabinet. Nika sorted through every drawer. Time pressed on, and Nika feared she'd hear the rumble of Dr. Santo's auto carriage returning before they found the Sanctuarium. At last, with few other rooms left in the house, their search led them to the conjoined carriage house, where Dr. Santo kept his vehicles. As soon as Nika stepped inside, her gut told her they'd found the right place. The room was chilled compared to the rest of the house. This was smaller than the Kongmi's carriage house, but it had space enough for auto carriages and horse tack, with one vehicle absent from Dr. Santo's earlier departure. Cochin moved toward a row of steel cabinets in the back, then threw a glance over his shoulder.
A medicine cabinet.
He removed his mask and drew close to the glass.
It's too dark to read.
Nika searched for a light switch. There was a chain dangling from the ceiling, and she yanked down on it. Dim yellowed light flooded the carriage house, and she joined Cochin's side at the cabinet to find its shelves full of glass bottles, stout and tall, with a variety of different clinical labels. They reminded her of her tinctures, leaf juices pressed in rubbing alcohol and corked in glass. These, however, sported their name, dose, and usages on the front, printed in a clear font. Nika scanned the labels, a variety of household medications she recognized, a cough syrup or two, and a few medications with names long enough to wrap all the way around their bottles. Then, on the bottommost shelf, she found their drug, Sanctuarium. With gloved hands, Cochin slipped open the cabinet door and grabbed the bottle, rearranged the others to conceal its absence, and held the drug up to the light. It was as he'd said, brown, labeled as a muscle relaxant, and missing a dose's worth of liquid. She and Cochin shared a look, and Nika let out a breathless gasp.
This is it?
This is it.
Then let's get out of here.
But she'd spoken too soon. They heard the creak of a floorboard, and lights turned on in the hallway.
Shit,
Cochin hissed, and pulled her flat against the wall. A sing-songy hum emanated from the house. Fear prickled through her, but all Nika could think about was how Cochin had spread his arm across her chest, how he leaned in so close she could hear his breath. They'd left the door to the carriage house open with the lights on. Here, pressed up against the wall, there were few places to hide without passing in front of the door. Nika wished for the cover of an auto carriage, but already, a shadow swayed on the other side. The sound of approaching footsteps halted just before the door, and the maid's humming stopped on a questioning lilt. Nika sucked in a breath. The footsteps drew closer. Nika tugged off her glove, preparing for the worst. Putting someone to sleep, that would be easy enough, just a matter of quieting the electricity in their brain. But if the maid saw them, it would all be over. Nika stepped forward as the shadow grew closer, but Cochin placed a hand on her arm. Nika looked at him, perplexed, as he passed her his mask and the bottle of Sanctuarium. He brought his finger up to his lips, then stepped toward the door. The maid screamed. Nika's heart spiked in her throat, fearing he'd hurt her, until she said,
Mr. Venn! Oh, you gave me such a fright. I thought I was alone in the house.
Sorry, Tinai. I was finishing up some work for Dr. Santo and thought I'd take the liberty of dropping it off myself.
Well, Nika heard the maid dusting off her clothing. I'll tell Dr. Santo you stopped by.
No need, Cochin said quickly. It's nothing important. Feel free to go home for the night. I can lock up after you're gone.
There was a tense pause, where Cochin blocked the door, and Tinai didn't respond.
Nika wondered if she would step past him, into the carriage house. If she did, even with how dim these bulbs were, she would see a girl garbed in all black, who certainly didn't belong. At last, Tinai let out an assentive sigh.
All right, Mr. Venn. Have a good night.
Good night, Tinai. A moment passed with some shuffling, and Nika watched Tinai's shadow shrink from the door. Only once she heard the footsteps recede and another door close in the distance did she let herself breathe again. Cochin wrung out a long exhale, then glanced at her.
Are you all right?
Yes. Nika drew her glove back on, still feeling her pulse in her arm. Her fingertips tightened around the glass bottle. You?
I'm fine.
He leaned against the door, flexing his hand as though it ached. I probably could have put her to sleep, Nika thought aloud.
I know, but I don't want either of us to have to use our heart soothing that way anymore. Not when we don't have to.
His eyes, when they met hers, were somber. It's all right. We should just go before we get caught. A solid breath escaped him.
I couldn't agree more.
Nika followed him out the back of the carriage house, ears trained for any more surprises. The night air brought a breath of relief, and she felt lighter to be rid of the house, of those shadowed walls and Dalton texts. She held on to the bottle of Sancronium like it was a buoy, and these Dragonborough streets were the roiling waves of a tsunami. As they started down the path toward the dinghy, Nika cast a final glance back at the mansion, the carriage house, and its dark windows. For a moment, an inkling of concern crawled up her throat as her mind lingered on the maid, on the consequences if she alerted Dr. Santo to their presence tonight. But those thoughts were quick to flee, as Cochin wrote them back. 24. When the exhumation date arrived, Nika and Cochin set out toward the Kongmi graveyard by dinghy, changed into somber attire, and taking the Sancronium with them. Everything hinged on this exhumation and the subsequent planting of the Sancronium in Dr. Santo's office. With each stroke of the oars, Cochin drew them closer to the cemetery where Mimi, Andao, and Trin awaited them. Nika had lied and trespassed and stolen before, but never had she felt this nervous. In the past, the worst she could lose was a handful of chem or her dignity, but today the livelihoods of those few she cared about had been thrown into the gambling pot. While he rode, Cochin's eyes scanned her face. Somehow, he could read her easily, and he asked,
"Worried?"
"A little," she admitted. She'd prepared for the exhumation mentally, but that did little to help the nervousness now.
"What for? Won't I be the one doing the soothing?" he teased.
It was best that way. Cochin had experienced soothing through drugs. "I'm worried on your behalf, then," she returned.
"Aren't you?"
His answer took a moment to come.
"I'm terrified," he admitted. "This is the first time I've defied Dr. Santo since I tried to leave the city. I keep fearing there'll be the same consequences as before, that he'll find something new to take from me. But more than worried, I'm hopeful."
"Hopeful?" Nika realized she was smiling.
"Yes. This isn't the first time I've tried to escape him, but it's the first time I'm not doing it alone."
His eyes glided over her, and a delicate smile tugged at his lips.
"I feel like everything I've learned under Dr. Santo has been preparing me for this. It's almost poetic."
"You knew how to soothe the Sancronium from Hendon's body because of Dr. Santo?"
"Yes. I've read enough of his papers to know what I was looking for. Heart soothing and medicine can be combined to amazing effect, but the world might never know that."
His expression turned solemn.
"He taught me to soothe dead bodies, too."
"He made you soothe dead bodies?" The thought was instinctively revolting to her, feeling death while soothing as intimately as she felt sickness.
"Donor corpses. He wanted me to restore dead organs for transplantation."
"I didn't know heart soothing could do that."
"I'm still not sure it can, really. I could return their function sometimes, but not in any way that satisfied him."
The memory must have been a distasteful one, because Cochin's eyes darkened.
"He always treated my gift like it was some kind of science."
Nika wanted to interject that it was science, something to be learned and taught, but his reverential tone told her he felt otherwise. What is it, if not a science?
I don't know, he said.
Magic? Nika fought her instinct to refute that. Coming from most, delegitimizing heart-soothing is magic, the same kind of paltry parlor tricks and sleight of hand performed before a half-enthused audience, had always been an attempt to disenfranchise people who possessed a gift that humans could never have. But from Cochin, the word held only wonderment.
Magic?
As in, something that could never be explained, no matter how hard we dissect it. Something where rules exist not as limits, but only to help us understand the next boundary. Where rules exist to be broken. His sentences came out as a collection of scattered thoughts, as though they'd only ever existed in his head, never aloud. It was a beautiful thing, the way he viewed heart-soothing. Such a perspective was rare within the industrialized confines of Thumis, but it must have been how the first heart-soothers viewed their abilities, labeled as a gift from the divine. The dreamy look in his eyes reminded Nika of her grandmother, who spoke of heart-soothing only ever as a blessing and a duty. Nika, however, could not accept it as magic, because this city had shown itself adverse to the inexplicable, and she didn't need another reason to feel as though she didn't belong. Strange, she thought, how two heart-soothers could know the art so differently, yet cling on to it with that same desperate, unending tenacity. They rounded the bend of the cliffside, and the dockyards came into view. Her anxiety lurched at the sight, knowing that a grim exhumation awaited them there. As long as she was here, on this dinghy, she could almost pretend that this moment would last forever. "What are you going to do when this is all over?" she asked. "You have a lot of money to spend." He snorted. "Maybe once I would have liked such an auspicious life, but I'm trying to settle for different ambitions now."
"Like what?"
He took a moment to think.
"Peace? Freedom?"
He shrugged.
"Love?"
She felt her heart stutter at the way he wrapped his breath around that last word. Peace. Freedom. Love. Words she understood, but couldn't conceptualize. "But just as lofty, aren't they?" He let out a humored breath. "Well, I think I might have stumbled into a couple already." Nika clenched her jaw when he turned his charming gaze on her, wondering if that had been a declaration, or if he hadn't meant it in that way. They'd both hidden behind so many second meanings and half-truths when they'd met at the funeral, when he was just a physician's aide to her. But Nika wanted nothing but openness with this Cochin.
"Freedom first. Then peace, right?" she said.
His eye twinkled, but he didn't respond directly. "After I'm free of Dr. Santo, I'm going to return to my family. It's long overdue, and with him behind bars, I can go home without the fear of bringing the city with me."
Nika smiled.
"Your mother misses you, Cochin. She'll be so happy to see you."
"I know."
Cochin gave their dinghy another solid stroke before he rested the oars. The boat slowed to an idle glide atop calm waters, bobbing up and down in time with the waves. He gave her an intent look, something shifting behind his eyes. A vulnerability that didn't come from heartache or fear, but from something new. She gave him a quizzical look.
"Why are we stopped?"
For a moment, he didn't answer. Instead, lacing his fingers together.
"I've been meaning to ask you something," he began.
His hesitance bled onto her. She'd never seen such a nervous side of him. After a pause, he continued.
"Nika, I'm sorry I tried to push you away when we first met. I was afraid, because I saw so much of myself in you, the person I was before Thumis. Now I see you're not like me at all. You're braver, smarter, fiercer. After this is all over, I'm going to go home. But there's something I need to know first."
His confession touched on naked sincerity, and she nodded, almost afraid of his next words.
Will you come with me?
The question settled into the bare wood of their dinghy, sank beneath the uneven waves. Nika only stared at him. He'd asked her before to go stay with his family. He'd nearly left her there. So, what was so different this time? When she didn't immediately respond, he added,
Only if you'd want to, of course. You would have the company of a family, one where heart-soothing is known and welcomed. My mother would love you, and so would my brothers, and I can help you find a home and a—
Why? She interrupted, scrutinizing him, the sudden depth of his dark eyes and soft line of his lips. Why do you want me to come? His brow crinkled.
Nika, isn't it obvious?
The Kongmis kept her because they needed her services. But Ko-Chin? The two of them had always been push and pull, him keeping her away, but always drawn back like gravity. Now he wanted to pull her in. But for what reason? If this is just another ploy to keep me safe and sequestered away, then Ven Ko-Chin, I swear! Ko-Chin leaned forward and kissed her. Nika drew a sharp breath of surprise before she succumbed to it, to his hands on her cheeks and his lips on hers. He must have been soothing her, or maybe she was soothing him. Nika couldn't tell. Her senses had rewired themselves, his touch overwhelming, and yet she'd never felt more at home in her own body. Ko-Chin drew her closer. A hand moved to her waist, and Nika came apart at his touch, muscle unwrapping from bone, nerves aflame, lungs bursting, a gesture to leave her breathless, followed by the warmth to restore it. At last, he pulled away, though he lingered just a hair's breadth, the space between them like the space between nerve endings, raw and electric. She wanted to kiss him again, but he murmured,
Does that answer your question?
Nika nodded, unable to conjure words. The dinghy rocked with the imbalance of their weight.
I didn't realize I could win arguments by kissing you, he said, giving her a smile as he drew back to arm's length.
He thumbed away a strand of her hair.
I want to leave this city, but I don't want to leave you. So, will you come with me?
This time, she understood. He'd asked her to come not because she was the only other heart-soothe, nor because he felt compelled to protect her. He'd asked her to come because he wanted her. Nika held his gaze as she processed the offer. There was nothing to leave behind. In Theumis, she'd already restarted her life a dozen times over, and the only thing she had of value was the ring she wore around her neck. If she had to do it again, if she were to choose something that might finally stick, then it would be with Ko-Chin.
Yes, she said, surer than she'd ever been.
Adrift on this dinghy, with the shadow of Theumis's cityscape far behind them, Nika felt the bubble of something true and overwhelming. Happiness.
I'll come with you.
Ko-Chin smiled, so wide and boyish that she couldn't help but return it.
I was hoping you'd say that.
Then, he kissed her again. 25. When they reached the Kongmi's private graveyard, they found it occupied by an intimate group. The siblings, Trin, Hendon, and a smattering of officials. No police cordon, no press, no aristocratic guests. It would seem the Kongmis had heeded the need for discretion. Trin came to open the gates for them at the bottom of the hill, giving Nika a stout greeting and Ko-Chin a wary look as he escorted them up the path. There, they met the others at the mausoleum, all dressed conservatively for the occasion.
There they are,
Hendon said, addressing the uniformed officers.
We can begin.
Nika surveyed those in attendance, a handful of constables, the groundskeeper, a criminalist, and a couple cemetery hands, each equipped with a bag of tools. They all drew closer as Trin swung open the gates of the mausoleum, but Nika noticed how Ko-Chin lingered back. She tilted her head in question, but he gave her a reassuring smile, just a quirk of his lip to say, I'll keep my distance.
Be our guest,
Andow said, sweeping a hand toward the cemetery workers, who then entered the mausoleum to remove Mr. Kongmi's body from its crypt. So the exhumation process went, slowly, awkwardly, and without any conversation. Everyone stared ahead at the mausoleum's closed gates, hearing some sort of chipping and grunting as the cemetery hands worked to remove the entombed casket. The last time she'd been in this graveyard had been for the procession, but today was nothing like that. The funeral had been gloomy, but now the sun beat down from a cloudless sky. Before, she had barely been able to think through the fanfare and clamoring of journalists, but now all she had were her thoughts. There was one more difference. She had felt so small then, seeing this graveyard spanned with the headstones of so many Kongmis, an ever-growing lineage immortalized in granite and marble. Now she realized that she didn't need this kind of remembrance in her passing. If all the difference she ever made in this city was not in graveyards nor children, but in the freedom of a single heart soothe, that would suffice. Maybe. That was all that legacy truly was. Remembrance from beyond the grave. It didn't need to be resounding, and it didn't need to be celebrated. It just needed to be. It was the same with heart-soothing, which had died a generation before her. But with her family's escape from Yarong, the legacy lived on in those like her, and like Cochin. A whisper, where there had once been a shout, but a voice nonetheless. And maybe that was enough. At last, the cemetery workers emerged from the mausoleum, signifying the adjournment of their work with a respectful bow. The criminalist started toward the gates, but Mimi lifted a hand.
If we may, Mimi began, could we request time to repay our respects alone?
The criminalist deferred to them. With a knowing look, Mimi ascended the steps to the mausoleum. Nika followed. Trin shut the gates behind them as they entered, leaving only the company of those in conspiracy. Compared to the monument it was on the outside, the mausoleum's inner sanctum felt claustrophobic and colorless, the light coming in dusty shafts from clear-story windows and walls ringed with crypts. There was space left for many generations of Kongmi heirs in these walls, with a single casket removed from its slot and sitting open at the center of the mausoleum. Mimi shuddered, searching for the comfort of her brother's side.
I can't look, she said, her voice small.
At first, no one dared approach the casket. Nika waited for their approval, the siblings, Trin's, even Hendon's. But when none came, she took it on herself to step forward. To her surprise, Mr. Kongmi did not look much different than he had the last time she'd seen him, perhaps the product of a good embalming and dry grave. The only difference was how everything had shrunken down on itself just a little, cheeks sallow, eyes hollow, and scalp tightening around the hair. Nika couldn't find it in herself to be disturbed or scared of a corpse. At the moment, she felt nothing but remorse for the act they were going to perform. With a subtle gesture, she called Cochin to her side. Then he withdrew the bottle and a needle and turned to the siblings. Mimi had her face turned into her brother's jacket, but Andow gave Cochin a permissive nod. Cochin drew up a healthy dose into the syringe. He moved to inject it into the dwindling muscle of Mr. Kongmi's deltoid, but stalled, the point of the needle wavering just over waxy skin. When Nika glanced at his face, the look behind his eyes was haunted. Seeing his repentance, as well as the Kongmi's renewed grief, her chest tightened. Nika wrapped her fingers around Cochin's hand, and together, they pushed the needle in.
Just a touch of cyanosis around the lips and a bit of spotting of the skin, and that should be enough, she said.
Cochin nodded, doffing his glove to soothe, but a noise from Mimi stilled him.
Wait,
she said, facing the body for the first time. Whatever words she'd prepared left her in an instant as her eyes fell upon her father. The heaviness of the moment seemed to dawn on her in parts, first as pain collapsing her stony expression, then as water welling to her eyes, and finally, as the violent tremble of her lip. She soldiered through it to say,
"Nika, can you do it instead?"
"Me?" Nika shared a look with Cochin, but he didn't object.
"Yes, I don't want—"
Mimi swallowed, reworked her words.
"I'd rather you do it."
From his stiffness, Nika could tell Cochin wanted to soothe Mr. Kongmi for her sake, but the sibling's preference held highest authority here. With a nod, Nika drew off her glove. Her fingers hovered over the corpse, unsure where to touch. Anywhere was a violation, one she hadn't personally been planning to commit today. But she'd been the one to insist on this plan, and soothing a corpse couldn't be so different from soothing someone living. When she couldn't decide, Cochin took her wrist in a light grip and guided it down to Mr. Kongmi's hands, laced over his chest. The fingers were cold and wax-like, but Nika fought the urge to draw away.
"Act as though they're alive," Cochin said. "It's easier that way."
Nodding, Nika rested her hand atop Mr. Kongmi's and pushed her influence inside. There, she found nothing awaited her. No electrical melody, no pulsing waterways, no swelling breath. Just the ghosts of anatomical architecture, bones so brittle she feared her influence might crack them, and muscles so sour she puckered on instinct. Nika fought her way toward his deltoid, trudging through the remains of clotted blood thick with the pungent odor of embalming fluid. "Act as though they're alive." Hard, when this body was so patently dormant, when the processes Nika relied on so heavily had come to a standstill, the vasculature like an abandoned train station whose empty halls echoed with commuters past. With much effort, she reached Mr. Kongmi's shoulder, biting back bile as the taste of the sanchoronium flooded her tongue. It was the one dynamic thing in this body, still suffusing through muscle. In a live body, if she wanted to expedite this process and circulate the drug through the entire body, she might have depended on the waking functions of the anatomy, the constant circulation of blood, the squeezing of muscles. Now, with her influence in a corpse, that grip she had on blood and muscle felt slack, useless. What's more, empathy with the dead made her feel corpse-like herself, limbs numbing and skin bloating and mouth drying. That stone of bile was rising quickly up her throat. A hand pressed against her shoulder.
"Take a step back," came Cochin's voice, as though it hovered just beside her ear. "Breathe."
He was right. She didn't need to be so close. Nika drew back, remembering how it was to soothe as he did, separate from the body. Her influence yanked from the corpse until she was looking down at the casket from above. Once she'd reoriented, Nika could see Mr. Kongmi as a whole. There was detail lost in doing so. She could not feel all his ailments and incongruities as if they'd mirrored onto her own body, but she saw him as he was, a dead man under her influence, and nothing more. No longer having to fight the disgust of inlaying herself upon a dead body, Nika soothed. Because Mr. Kongmi had no energy stores readily available, she used only her own. Otherwise, the processes were easy enough, flexing muscles and squeezing the heart, tightening vessels and stippling the skin. Nika didn't change much. She would not violate the Kongmi's father any more than she had to, and it only took a couple minutes once she'd started. By the time she pulled away, shuddering off the last omen of death, Mr. Kongmi did not look wholly unchanged. However, another medical examination might find something amiss, enough to begin investigations.
"Are you done?"
Mimi asked, voice fragile. "Yes," Nika said, drawing her glove back over her hand. For once, she was glad for the confines of silk, something to quiet her gift for a moment. With a note of heartbreak, She could see how, after years of doing this at Dr. Santo's behest, Cochin could learn to hate something that had only ever been beautiful to Nika.
"Are we ready to hand him over to the medical examiners?" Hendon asked.
"Before we do, may we have a true moment with our father?"
Mimi asked. She didn't wait for a response before stepping up to the casket, coaxing Trin and Andow to follow. The rest of them gave the trio their space, Cochin diverting his eyes as though his audience itself was sacrilege. Nika couldn't look away, her eyes lingering on the way Trin and Andow interlaced their gloved hands, on the way Mimi fit so perfectly between them. Seeing that unbroken trio now, Nika wondered why she'd ever thought she could belong among them. They were already so complete. The Kongmis had reminded her of what it meant to belong somewhere, but her place was not with them, and Nika was beginning to understand that.
"Father, if all of Thumis is wrong, and an afterlife does exist, forgive us for this," Mimi confided to concrete walls and a solemn audience. "It was always so clear what you lived for. Your automatons, your children, your city. We've learned what you died for as well, exposing your own friend. Now that I know, Father, I promise I won't leave your work unfinished."
Mimi bowed her head in conclusion, and Andow and Trin bent over to whisper some final words of their own, the echo of the mausoleum making their speeches indiscernible. Once they were done, they stepped back from the casket, and Nika found something new in Mimi's eyes. Resolution, as though she'd matured 5 years in a moment. Perhaps it was the look of closure. Having finished their business, they gathered the evidence of their tampering and exited the mausoleum. As they walked down the stairs, Trin appeared at Nika's side, drawing her attention with a touch on the shoulder.
"I'm sorry," she said on instinct, because she felt like a trespasser here, in Mr. Kongmi's body, in the mausoleum, in this entire graveyard.
"Don't apologize," he said. "We've been theorizing about what happened to Mr. Kongmi since his death, and you gave us our answer. Perhaps it was an answer we didn't want to hear, but it's an answer. Mimi won't admit it, but she's grateful."
"I didn't mean to unbury their grief along with their father."
"If it's how we get justice, then so be it. The siblings are stronger than they look."
Trin watched her out of the corner of his eye, rocking back on his heels.
"And it's in both of our interests. This helps you and Mr. Venn, and we'll make sure Dr. Santo sees punishment for what he's done."
"A suitable transaction," Nika said. That's what her relationship with the Kongmis had always been, right? Services for a price. Convict their murderer, this time at the cost of fresh bereavement.
"Well, I should hope that it would be more than that. I don't consider you just an accomplice in whatever this is. I consider you a friend."
Trin cleared his throat, as though the small admission was too much for him. He glanced at Cochin down the road.
"But you're not planning to stay in Thumis, are you?"
She shook her head. "This city has never wanted me."
"I understand. Whatever it is you're looking for, Nika, I hope you find it. Tonight, when you plant the rest of the Sanctuarium in Dr. Santo's office, I want to be there to help. A way of saying thank you. And I'm glad you came into our lives, even if you can't stay."
Nika gave him a wry smile. "Not everyone can be adopted into the wealthiest family in Thumis, can they?"
"No, I suppose not."
Out of the corner of her eye, she found Cochin standing by the gate. She gave Trin a bow in parting, feeling lighter for having talked to him.
"I'll see you tonight, then."
"Nika,"
he said, catching her.
"For what it's worth, I didn't think you killed their father. You're soft underneath that dangerous act."
She faked a front. "You wound me, Dep Trin." With a grin, Trin nodded his farewell, and Nika turned down the path, her eyes lingering on the family for just a moment. This might well be the last time she'd see this company in its entirety like this, as flesh and bone, rather than portraits on the front page. She memorized them as they were now, gracious enough to let her back into their lives, if even just for an exhumation. Nika joined Cochin at the bottom of the cemetery gates. He stood outside the fence, hands clasped behind his back as he watched the criminalist begin her work. The pensiveness in his eyes was as deep as the ocean.
"Do you ever think we're the last ones?"
he asked in a solemn tone as he surveyed the graveyard. So, the morbid affairs had gotten to him too. "The last heart suits?" she asked.
"Yes."
Nika shifted her jaw and thought. "I always knew I couldn't be, but it didn't make any difference if I felt like I was. What do you think?" Cochin's brow set with pessimism.
"I think it dies with us, our generation."
"How can you be so sure?"
"My grandmother passed the gift to my mother, and my mother to me, but not to my brothers. Who knows if I'll pass it to my children, if I even get that far.
So, how could it ever grow stronger? It can only get weaker, and smaller, and further from us. How are we supposed to keep it alive?" Nika had often felt the same. Her grandmother would lament that, with no more teachers, the art would die. But ever since she'd met Cochin, heart-soothing had come alive again, captured in rotting journals, exchanged between two schools, warmed by shared experiences. He'd shown her that heart-soothing survived through more than its tenets and rites and teachers. It survived simply through its people. "You live, Cochin. As long as you live, your heart-soothing lives, whatever form that might take. That would be enough."
"And when we're gone?"
"Then we find someone who will remember us as we want to be remembered." Even if heart-soothing was forgotten, its teachers wiped from Thumis and Nyerong, some small part of it would exist forever, passed down from mother to daughter, immortalized in small acts of healing, shared with those who'd forgotten. Just like her bone ring, a shard for every heart-soothe in her lineage, lost, but never forgotten. Nika reached into her shirt and drew out the ring, which she held out to him. She'd never shown it to anyone, because no one else could appreciate it. But that was before she'd met Cochin.
"A Yarongi's bone ring?"
he asked incredulously, eyes rimmed with awe. He cupped it with his palm, inspecting the characters on the inner band.
"What does this say?"
"Swanya-san," she responded. "My family name."
"Ah, I remember," he said,
his smile soft and voice mesmerized. The sincerity of his gaze was almost too much to look at. She'd never known anyone who could appreciate her as he did. He put into words the nuance of it, something she'd never endeavored to do. Because what were words worth if no one could understand them? But now he existed, and as Nika gazed upon his thoughtful smile, his gloved hands, his dark eyes, she was glad he couldn't soothe her now. If he did, he might notice the soft tremor in her heart that stuttered in time with his breaths, or he might catch the redness in her cheeks, stifle those vessels though she might. Maybe, just maybe, he might even feel the heat surfacing on the back of her hand, still burning where he'd once kissed her. Nika pulled her gaze toward the pavement. Suddenly, he was at once too close and too far away. How long had she been looking for someone like him? Someone who knew her fears and her joys as they truly were. Someone who might remember and keep safe her family name as it truly was. And someone who might deign to keep her close, not as a blood carver, nor even as a heart soothe, but as Nika, just Nika. It had never been a probable fantasy for her. Who would know what she was and still let her touch them? Hers was not a touch that held, or caressed, or kissed. Hers had always been the touch that carved. But he was the marble that weathered. When she looked back up at him, the humor had melted away, and the line of his smile had softened. He straightened, returning the ring and looking again toward the mausoleum.
Thank you, Nika. You were right about the loneliness. Before you, I'd never considered there might be a way out of my binds. When I was alone, I just had this hopelessness. There was no sense in tomorrow, because Dr. Santo dictated my hours, my days, my life. At some point, I think I resigned myself to it, an indentured life, because even if I was suffering, at least it was just me. If I hurt, or stumbled, or fell, if I didn't want to wake up to another day, if I hated myself at the end of it, then it was just me.
Her heart squeezed as a sedated melancholy touched his expression. He gave her a wan smile, humor belying the grief in his eyes, and she felt tears burn through her nose. He'd put it into words, the feeling that had haunted her for so many years. For a moment, she was 8, surrounded by family, her home whole.
What I mean to say, Nika, he continued, is that you remind me of someone I used to be, someone I was proud of, and you give me hope that I can be him again. I don't know if you understand how much that means to me.
I do. The words left her tongue in a rush. Trust me, I do. With a soft smile, Cochin reached out and took her hand. They wore gloves. The gesture was not a heart-soothed one, but a human one. Just two lonely people who had been denied the grand promises of their city, so they found meaning in small acts of connection instead. In the bone ring around her neck, in the closeness of their bodies, and in the way he squeezed her fingers just for a pulse, a silent promise that she would never be alone again. The gesture, however small, was enough. Her chest crushed with a distant, unfamiliar ache. Not pain, not sadness, peace, freedom. And that final word, she dared not speak aloud.
26. Night came with the lighting of gas lamps and the hum of incandescent bulbs. On the houseboat, Nika and Cochin gathered their things, a half-empty bottle of Sancaronium, and enough equipment to perform the second break-in. Everything that would be evidence, they handled exclusively with gloves. They made the trip to the Thumis Medical Center on foot. In the darkness, the building held an eerie look, the arched windows too shadowed, and the wide doors like those of a prison. She could see that activity still carried on in the adjacent emergency complex at the rear of the medical center, but the front had dimmed with a quietness like death. There, the lot held only a single auto carriage with darkened windows, but Nika knew who it belonged to before Trin opened the door. He and Mimi stepped out, and Nika felt an echo of the past, seeing those two in the auto carriage as it had been when she'd first met them. This time, Mimi was not in white silks, but dark ones, and Trin was not so nervous. With his pistol on his hip, and thick arms crossed like corded dragons, Trin looked ready.
I'll enter at the first sign of trouble, he promised, giving them that singular, reliable nod that she'd come to expect.
Leave nothing to question, Mimi said, an offer of luck.
With murmured affirmations, Nika and Cochin started toward the medical center, but Mimi caught her sleeve before she could go.
Nika,
she began, her eyes downcast with something between bashfulness and nervousness.
I wanted to let you know, in case I forget later, that I didn't just come to see things through to the end. I came for you.
Nika's lips parted with surprise. For me?
To apologize. For everything, really, Mimi said, looking sheepish. I said a lot of things I regret, and I should never have accused you. But you came back anyway. Healed Hendon, too. It's more than we deserved.
You do still plan on paying me when this is over, right? Mimi laughed.
I suppose that's due. We'll make sure you're cared for. I want to see you happy. And if that's with him, then so be it. I don't think I can stand to see him again in my life, so before you depart with him, I want to help you find your happy ending too, as a way of thanks. We won't forget this, Nika. I won't forget you.
Nika's chest bloomed with something pleasant. This was how it felt then, to be remembered. Now she understood why the Kongmis had claimed their graveyards and erected their mausoleums.
I won't forget you either, Nika promised.
And then, whim seized control of her, and she placed a palm atop Mimi's head with all the familiarity of a sister. Mimi didn't shy away from the touch. She only beamed.
How could you? Mimi simpered. I'm sure the Kongmi name will follow you wherever you flee to in Thumis.
That drew a laugh from Nika. Be good to Trin, Nika said, casting a weary look at the cross-armed bodyguard standing by the autocarriage. I'll be back soon. With a wink and parting, she joined Cochin at the medical center. They chose a door that faced the lots, and she set to work on it with her lockpicks. With all the practice she'd had these past few weeks, the lock came easily undone. Quietly, they slipped into the building, leaving Mimi and Trin to await them outside. This door led into the main foyer, vast and empty. Chairs lined the waiting area like gravestones, and the arched windows splayed long shafts of moonlight across white tile. Nika heard the echoic tick of cogwork somewhere down the hall, machines running on command rolls left inside, and had to remind herself that she didn't believe in ghosts. But how many had died within these walls? How many with unfinished business?
I've never seen this place so empty, Cochin whispered, his breath catching on awe. It's almost beautiful.
That wasn't the word I'd have chosen, she said. Maybe something more like creepy.
Scared of ghosts? He teased.
Scared of becoming one. Mother knows I won't be allowed in heaven.
Not to worry. We can avoid all the surgical wards. Just for you.
And not for the fact that his office is just upstairs? She asked. Fourth floor, if she remembered correctly.
Certainly not.
The moonlight caught his boyish grin. Their footsteps echoed up and down the stairs in the silence. Nika hadn't remembered the hike to be so long, but every sound became a possible night guard or a lost emergency physician. With such an open atrial floor plan, Nika felt vulnerable, her silhouette cast in moonlight every time she rounded a window. But soon, surely, they made it to the fourth floor, where they turned down the hall. This space afforded them the privacy of walls. Nika remembered this walk in the daylight, the bustle of secretaries and physicians and researchers. Now it echoed with each footstep, deathly quiet. With its dark lacquered walls and plush carpet, it resembled the inside of a casket. The long hallway unnerved her. She expected a ghostly figure to be